Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest on today's show is David Ebert, retired lawyer and founder of the Weeping Elephant Project, which, according to its website, focuses on the awfulness of the use of captive elephants for zoos, circuses, and other forms of supposed entertainment. Ebert has been working on behalf of captive elephants in the U.S. for more than a decade. It's important to note that the Weeping Elephant Project is currently in the midst of an investigation of Busch Gardens, Tampa Bay. In the section of the Weeping Elephant Project website devoted to that investigation, under a heading entitled "A Lack of Accountability," they report, quote, "Rather than addressing the concerns, management told keepers not to document the elephants' negative reaction to stressors such as fireworks, rides, and roller coaster construction," end quote. A little further into that account, it notes that two elephants there were euthanized just 2 years apart. This refers to Korea in July 2026 and Rosie 2 years earlier. Find out more about this investigation, about the Weeping Elephant Project, and more when I speak with David Ebert in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Programming note, though, in just under 2 weeks, on September 22nd, WMNF's Fall Fun Drive begins, and I'll be raising money on Talking Animals the very next day, Wednesday, September 23rd. Typically assign a giant fundraising goal, especially for a one-hour show. I learned over the years that the only real prospect of reaching such a big goal is to receive pledges before the fun drive show gets underway. How about today, for example? So I'm hoping you might consider making an early pledge in support of Talking Animals. With Trump stripping away the state and federal funding for public broadcasting, success with these fund drives has become even more important than ever. So just please visit WMNF.org and in the upper right-hand corner, click on Donate Now. Then you can kind of work your way into a drop-down menu. And just please select TLA, Talking Animals, so that our show is credited with your donation. Thank you so much. Meanwhile, coming up later on today's program, I'll speak with Noah Greenwald, Endangered Species Co-Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, who will discuss newly available info that indicates the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has lost some 36% of its staff under the Trump administration. Problematic implications for endangered species, as you might imagine, and in other regards as well. We'll get key details when I speak with Noah Greenwald later in today's program. Right now, though, let's get into our conversation about the Weeping Elephant Project, about its investigation in Busch Gardens, Tampa Bay, and more with David Ebert. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. I'm pleased to welcome David Ebert to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Duncan. Thank you for the introduction, and thank you for having me here today.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. Really excited to talk to you and find out more about the various things you've been doing. Obviously, Weeping Elephant Project, but there's things before and about that that we really want to delve into. But first of all, let's just get to a little bit of a background on you. So I understand that you enjoyed a 30-plus year career practicing law. What kind of law was that?
I wouldn't say I enjoyed it, Duncan.
Okay. How about you endured a 30-year
law? Barely. Yes, I was a lawyer for 33 years. I was a commercial litigator and worked mostly in New York and some around the country, but mostly my work was in New York, which is where we were based.
And for some of us who aren't as steeped in the law as others, what is commercial litigation involved doing?
Fighting over money.
Okay.
No, it's real. It's,
yeah, when it boils
that really
down to
is
it, right?
It. Yeah. That's what it is.
What did you like about it? I'm sure there was something to keep doing for 33 years, but I get the sense so far the way you've answered that, you know, you didn't necessarily love it or love all the aspects of it for the 33 years.
I was good at it, but I was ill-suited to it. So how did I do it for 33 years? Was You start a career and you get involved in it, and it's easier to stay than to leave, make that kind of change. But there were aspects I did enjoy.
Yeah, I'm
And
sure. I mean, it's hard to imagine. A key thing you mentioned is that you were good at it. So I'm sure that's one thing that kind of kept propelling you along. And on some level, you probably had to enjoy at least certain days given that.
I did. There were certain tasks and trials and pre-trial busing that, yes, was enjoyable. But I can't. But I'm much happier now doing what I'm doing now. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, so let me ask you that then. While you were engaged in working in commercial litigation, to what extent were you also working on behalf of animals to any regard?
Over the course, I had tried to find some place where I could help in helping animals, and I went to some meetings and met with some organizations, and nothing was really a fit. I was toward my retirement in 2016. I decided that I wanted to start something of my own and having to do with animals, and the only thing I knew how to do really was be a lawyer.
Yeah.
And
So just to back up before what you said before, so
sure.
during the time that you were still practicing and you were trying to, it sounds like trying to like already step into the animal world in some regard, and then you brought, hey, I'm a lawyer here. Was it really not a fit or just was kind of ill-timed overall, just given that you were still had a full practice going?
It really, you mean to being a lawyer as a fit?
Well, you said you couldn't really find a good fit when you sort of had made
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm
exploratory
sorry.
moves into the animal world before you had completed your law career.
I'm sorry. Yeah. It I didn't find it. I didn't find any place where I thought I can contribute. There were organizations that I could have worked with, but I didn't feel like I'd be doing anything to help animals beyond what the organization was already doing. And my interest was in doing something directly that would make a difference in how the people who are advocating for animals do their work.
Yeah, and I'm curious then, was there a time prior to law school and practicing law that you were involved with animals in any way, rescue, welfare, anything, or just having animals at the house even, or?
I didn't do anything formal, but somehow it's always been an interest, and I just tried to do the best I could given the time that I had
Yeah.
when I was working for a lawyer beforehand. It was always there. I can't tell you it was an event or something that happened that triggered it, but it was always there. This wanting to do something to help end animal suffering or reduce it at least.
So it kind of sounds like when it comes to working with animals, there arguably might be two distinct segments to the David Ebert narrative: law career and post-law career. Like, really, once it finished, then it sounds like you were able to dive in and kind of explore stuff. Plus, you wanted to do your own thing, at least as much as offer your services, which sounds like you already had offered your services to some organizations while practicing at that point.
Yeah, the thing we came up with, the first organization that I co-founded was Animal Defense Partnership,
Yeah, definitely want to talk about that.
and the point of it was that we would provide free legal services to animal protection nonprofits. So we're not in the field; we're helping the organizations that are in the field navigate the things that any business has to do in dealing with legal issues as they come up. And that was what I came up with best I could, and I had no idea it was going to grow into what it has grown. And
What has it grown into? I mean, how
yeah,
from where you started, what does it currently look like?
when I stepped away last year, so I was there. I was at ADP for 9 years. And in that time, we did work for some 450 clients. And in the year before I left, we provided if you were actually billing for services, $2.2 or $2.3 million in services. It was, I never imagined it. But it just kept growing, and there was a need that needed to be filled, and plenty of organizations that needed the help.
Yeah, when you say stepped away, I guess in case it got missed in our first reference or two, I mean, if I have this correctly, you kind of helped conceive and co-founded, I guess, this organization, right? So it wasn't like you were just sort of there. And
No.
It was kind of partly your baby.
It was completely my baby, and at the outset, I did everything that there was to do. It's not exactly fair. My partner also did aspects that he could do. But I didn't know anything about nonprofits. I didn't know what was involved. I didn't know what an executive director was. I just knew I wanted to do this work for animals. So I sort of did it all, made all the mistakes that one makes in any new endeavor. And as it grew, we brought in more people, exceptional people. We brought in, finally, I was the unnamed ED, which I was not really qualified to be. We finally brought in an ED who...
And we should clarify that sounds for executive director in case...
I'm sorry.
I'm sure most people listening probably would recognize that, but maybe not all of them.
Yeah, so we brought her in, Jacqueline Leeds, and she was very, very well suited to the position, and she's a lawyer and feels deeply about animals. So that took away much of what I was doing day to day. And excuse me.
Bless you.
I was the legal director. I was figuring out how to take in the work and how to get the work to people who were going to do the work. And that took up a great deal of time and speaking to, I spoke to every client who contacted us to talk about what we do and find out what they do. And we hired a legal director, somebody who I actually was a partner with in my prior law firm. And so she did that, and she did it brilliantly. And there was not much left that I needed to do. I was a board member, but that really wasn't doing it for me, being one of six people that would approve budgets, guide the organization, but in a remote way, in a sense, that wasn't doing it for me. And
yeah,
over the time that I was at ADP, I had done some sort of one-off elephant projects. I contacted organizations that did elephant work and said that this is who I am and this is what I like to do, and did these projects as ADP was growing as an organization that provided legal services. And that was, the elephant work was, it was horribly discouraging because it's a very difficult thing to accomplish, to get an elephant out of a zoo, for instance.
Can you just back up for one more second?
Yeah,
sorry,
yeah.
Just because I was interested when you were talking about ADP, if you could give us an example of one or two forms of legal assistance that ADP provided. Sounds like there was a huge number of clients that came through, and I'm sure they all had, some of them at least had quite varied needs for what your help that you were offering. So I'd just be curious to hear an example or two.
We incorporated organizations. We taught organizations how to be a nonprofit, did the paper that they need to do to become a nonprofit, counseled them in employment matters and in contract negotiations. Employee disputes, not surprisingly, were a large part of it. Not surprisingly, because it's a large part of any practice where you're dealing with organizations that have people in them. And whatever would come up, if there were a dispute between our organization, our client and somebody else, we would try to make that better. There was nothing that we didn't do. I mean, we didn't do anything that would constitute malpractice. But if somebody had a legal problem, we either knew how to do it or figured out how to do it. And it's the everyday you know, I'm entering into this contract. Can you review this before I do it?
Yeah.
Somebody gave me a non-disclosure agreement to sign. Should I sign this? And you'd review the agreement and talk to them about why you should or why you shouldn't. And every day was something new.
Well, I see why it grew tremendously and wildly, because, I mean, what a godsend you guys were to organizations who I found over the years. I've been talking to all kinds of people with all kinds of organizations, and certainly well-meaning, and they come in with the right passion, whatever, but sometimes they don't look at the financial aspect, or even just getting a nonprofit, just getting a 501c3
right
together is like a daunting task. So the fact that you were able to do all those things for them basically free of charge, I mean, it's, seriously, that's hitting the jackpot for so many organizations.
Thank you. It's tremendously satisfying, and I'm overwhelmingly proud of the organization, which is still operating today and doing great work. It was a little hard at the beginning to explain what we were doing. We would talk to people.
Well, it probably sounded too good to be true, I'm sure, to a lot of organizations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I'd say, they'd say, okay, this all sounds great. How much does it cost? And I say, it's not going to cost you anything. We cover all the expenses. It costs nothing. Okay, I get that, but I don't know that I have enough money to pay you guys to do this work. And we say, no.
If you'll back up 3 minutes, I mentioned that we're not charging you anything, but they just couldn't accept it because it was such an amazing experience, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. It was hard for people to take in. And, you know, after a couple of years, you become a presence and people know what you're doing. It's much less of a surprise, but people, organizations, and advocates were very appreciative, and I loved working with all of them.
Yeah. Do you miss it?
No. No.
Okay.
I mean, it helped. I couldn't have done ADP if I hadn't been a lawyer. Right. That was
right.
The skill that I brought to it.
Sure.
I couldn't have done Weeping Elephant if I had not done ADP, because in the course of ADP, I got into this network of animal protection advocates, animal people, and made all kinds of relationships, new funders, knew what people were doing, new people who was supporting us, was supporting the work that I was intending to do. None of that would have been possible if I just one day sat down and said,
so
okay, I'm
a
nonprofit.
Key step in the process that led you to the Weeping Elephant.
Yeah. The progression makes perfect sense between lawyer and ADP and Weeping Elephant. I didn't plan it. I can't take credit for that, but that's how it played out.
All right, well, I'm just, in case some people may have tuned in later, I'm going to reintroduce you, and I think we might have a call that we want to work into the conversation as well. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is David Ebert, retired lawyer and founder of the Weeping Elephant Project, which is in the midst of an investigation of Busch Gardens, Tampa Bay, where two elephants were euthanized in just the last 2 years or so. If you'd like to ask David a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. Okay, let's get this. I'm not sure what this caller has in mind, but we'll find out soon enough. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with David Ebert.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Duncan. Just another astounding guest this week. I just want
flattery will get you everywhere, just so you know.
I'm blushing. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice, but I'm blushing.
I want to know how I can help. This is exactly what I want to do. I want to be to use the French term, advocate for animals legally. I, 30 years ago, graduated from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, with a degree in political science pre-law. And have not found anything that has met my highly analytical job niche.
Yes.
I am currently employed. I'm not asking for a job. I want to volunteer. But I find so few organizations. I actually have looked into going to law school. I had to defer law school at U of M. It just didn't work out for me. But at this point, I've looked at the Vermont Law School program. I think they have animals. But
yes.
Anything that I can do to help animals in the judicial system, would love to hear your response.
I would contact ADP and talk to them about what you want to do and what your qualifications are. And they're always looking for people good people who are doing legal work who can help out. And I think if you contact them, I would contact Jacqueline Leeds, who's the executive director, and talk it through. It may be that there's something there that you can contribute that's not available now, or something that you could bolster that they would be tremendously appreciative, as would I. And that's you could, there's also ALDF, Animal Legal Defense Fund. And
yes.
ALDF.
I've contacted one of their representatives. She also is from Michigan. I think she works out of the D.C. office. But the schedule has just not worked out for her and I to have like a Zoom call to tell her what my interest is. Yeah.
Right. And they do something very specific and something very different from ADP. They litigate cases. They pursue lawsuits. And there was some confusion early on, but that was never what we wanted to do at ADP. So they covered the fighting part of it, and we covered the making it possible for these organizations to fight part.
Got it.
All right. Well, thanks, Carla. We're going to move along, but thanks. I'm glad you're enjoying the conversation with David, and good luck to you. Okay, so David, let's get into the Weeping Elephant Project. So it sounds like between the ADP work, there was things that intrigued you about the complications and plight and all kinds of other things about elephant work. Is that what drew you, or was there something else about elephants that spoke to you and sort of drew you in this direction?
Well, learning about who they are and how they live, it was of tremendous interest, and I'm still learning things that I didn't know.
Can you say a little bit more about learning who they are and how they live? Because I think that anybody that's kind of intrigued by elephants or passionate about them probably shares a similar thing, depending on how you...
Sure. They have characteristics that are inexplicable. They communicate with each other by producing low-frequency rumbles, which are transmitted through the ground, which are read by the receiving elephant through their feet, and from very long distances. And I keep thinking about that, and I've written about it, and it's still like, how can this be? It's just
keeps the eavesdropping down on their conversations, for starters.
That's right. They some of this, I don't know that it's you could prove for real, but there's scientific work on elephants having names for each other. Elephants grieve. There's no doubt about that. When a family member dies, you might have the herd of elephants that elephant was with. Sorry. Gather around that dead elephant and pay their respects in whatever way we might see that's paying respects. But they are there, and they feel a loss. And mothers who have calves that die, they might carry them around for a week. I mean, it's heartbreaking, but the social bonds, the matriarchal aspect of it is very interesting to me, and they take care of each other.
Right, they're emotionally complex, and the other thing you talked about grieving and supporting each other and being very protective, and that may or may not be somewhat hooked to being matriarchal, but yeah, no, I know what you mean, and I think you had some sort of, I think when you were early on sort of making your transition to elephant work, I think you had some sort of amazing, it sounds like, experience with an elephant.
I did.
I'm
happy to. I'd gone to Africa three times. The first time was to see the Rwandan gorillas. The second time was the Ugandan gorillas. And then it was to go see elephants. And I stayed at Sheldrick, which is a well-known sanctuary orphanage, and stayed a couple of minutes away from where the orphans were. And you would see them every day, and you would be in contact, not physical contact necessarily, but you would go there every day and watch what they did and try to understand some of what was happening. And there was one elephant. You should not ever touch a wild elephant. They shouldn't. That's not something to do. But there was one elephant. Shakura was the name, who had a horrible beginning, and was never going to be returned to the wild. And Shakura, they permitted people to touch her, which just touching an elephant is. I get a chill. I just said it and I get a chill. And I would see her every day and touch her every day. And they would go out into the woods and they'd come back And I felt like I had some connection to her. The last day when I was leaving, I made relationships with the keepers and people working there, and we were sort of doing the hugging thing. I was there for a week, and it was my last day, and saying goodbye. And the elephants, they walk out in the line, as most people have seen, and toward the back of that line was this elephant, Shakuru, and she was walking with the herd, and then she stopped and she turned around and walked maybe, I don't know, 10 yards, 15 yards to me, to come over to me and to stand with me. You could attribute that to all kinds of things, but that never happened on any other day. This was the day I was leaving, and there was some demonstration of that. And you could say it's coincidence. You could say it can't be. But that elephant came to say goodbye, and that changed my perspective completely about elephants and what we don't know about them. And I think we know, as much as we know a tiny bit of what they're actually capable of, and how they live their lives. It was a life-changing experience.
Yeah, she read the situation. She clearly understood that that was your last day, and you guys had made this, forged this connection. So she came over expressly to sort of say goodbye, pay her respects, you know.
That's how I see it.
Yeah. Well, like you say, it could be a coincidence, could be a lot of other things, but you were there for a week. Nothing like that happened with her or anybody else. So it's one hell of a coincidence if it's a coincidence. Yeah.
I'm certain in my own body that was not a coincidence.
Yeah.
And it's what you want to believe, right? But I'm certain that elephant came over. And as she was coming over, it didn't really register. And one of the keepers said, do you know what's happening here? And they said, she's saying goodbye to you. And it just blew me up. It just changed my perspective on animals and elephants in particular.
Yeah. Well, again, if people that work with elephants every day are saying she came to say goodbye, I think, you know, you're going to be further hard pressed to be talked out of that being your own impression.
I will not be talked out of it.
And don't get into an argument with a commercial litigation lawyer. I probably good advice. Yeah.
Well, this is, I believe it.
Yeah.
I lived it, and I believe that's what happened.
So did that give you, sounds like kind of an inspiration to go more further in the direction you sort of were, sounds like toying with at that point, because you wouldn't have gone to see the elephants if you weren't already thinking of how can I take my work and my experience with ADP into a different direction?
Exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah, I was there in 2019, so that was 3 years into ADP, and it certainly gave me a different level of motivation to work with animals in general and elephants in particular. I hadn't thought of weeping elephant in any way at that point, but that changed my drive to do it and what I wanted to accomplish in helping these animals.
So what sort of became then, after that experience, what became the mission of Weeping Elephant Project that you sort of, sounds like, honed in on?
Yeah, so what I would say to people when they ask me what it's going to be, and I said, well, this is what I say it's going to be, but by the time we get into doing the work, it's going to be something completely different. I knew enough to know that. And it was, I'm sorry.
Getting a bit emotional, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Elephants
will do that to you.
Yeah, it's. I'm sorry. I've enthralled myself enough to have forgotten what I wanted to say.
But, well, when you're kind of saying it, when people ask you what it would be, you started to say something, but knew that it was going to change at some point for what it would actually become.
Right. So the original, my original mission, if you will, was to address captive elephants in circuses and zoos, and to find ways to educate people and tell them why they shouldn't be going to the circus and they shouldn't be going to the zoo and what's actually happening that they don't see. They see an elephant doing some absurd, humiliating trick, and they don't know what went into making that elephant do that, not to mention a wild elephant complying with anything. And the process that they have to go through is horrific, and I won't go through it now. But that was that's what originally I wanted to work on, and I hired a communications guy, Evan Shamoon, and I hired Daniel Carnahan as our executive director, who were both exceptional. I mean, exceptional people and exceptional at what they do. And it was a process of talking about what we were going to do and how we were going to do it and tools that we put together. And it evolved into us being, well, a large part of it now is investigating situations where elephants are being mistreated, to understate it, and to try to do something about that. And the something is the something that we all sort of call to is, well, we got to get them to a sanctuary. The problem is that there's no place in sanctuaries to put many elephants. There are 3 sanctuaries in the U.S., and there's not a lot of room. And there are 285 captive elephants in the U.S. So, you know, free all the elephants, great, but where are you going to put them?
Yeah.
So it became a matter of, okay, well, that's the reality of this. So how do we do something that will make a difference for how they live, assuming that you're not going to get them out of a zoo or a circus? And we try, at ADP, I talked about these sort of one-off projects, and I worked on a couple of efforts to get elephants out of horrible situations in a roadside zoo and traveling circus, and it's very, very difficult.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's look at how hard people worked for how many years to get the ringling situation, to
yes.
change. And then you look at roadside zoos that, you'd think it'd be easier because it's like one or two elephants and some guy, but in some ways it's worse just because the guy's worse. And So how did you arrive at the decision to investigate Busch Gardens, Tampa Bay then?
Well, the way it went was Danielle went to a conference, an elephant conference, and through that made a connection to somebody who was a former keeper at Busch Gardens who talked to her about her experience there. And she was willing, this is extraordinary, she was willing to be on the record, to use her name, to use her face, to tell people what was going on. And once we had that, it was it just changed the whole thing. And we interviewed her, and we can use clips from her, and we can have her speak. And people, you can believe it or not, but this woman worked there, and she saw this firsthand and told us about what was happening. And we had a basis to go in because we had facts, if you will, unless people think she was making it up. And we had somebody who could support it and wanted to go in and see if we could make it better. After she came forward, we got a number of people contacting us anonymously, telling us of their experience at Busch Gardens. And, anonymous is tricky, but when you hear 4, 5, 6 anonymous tellings of a story that are consistent, you can put some weight to that. And And what we decided to do is to do this campaign, which would be to send emails to Busch Gardens and the AZA, the American Zoological Association, and Animal Zoological. So, I'm sorry, I get that wrong. But we put this out, and you know, we put it on social media. We sent it to our mailing list, and as of yesterday or today or whatever, there are 110,000 emails that have gone to the bad guys.
And what would typically, I'm sure they vary widely, but what would one of those emails be like that they would receive?
They would say, we're aware of what's going on. This is completely unacceptable. I'm never going to go to Busch Gardens again or ever. And we urge you to stop what you're doing and let it be done differently. And they weren't hysterical. They weren't, they were calm and they were smart. And it said, you're doing this and you can't be doing this anymore. And I thought, okay, maybe we get 1,000 letters, 2,000 letters, maybe 100 letters. So 110,000, I still check it to make sure that I'm saying the right number.
Right.
Because I find that...
beyond what your expectations were as far as the campaign goes.
Yes.
So here's the $110,000 question, I guess, then. So... What impact has that had, or what impact are you guys hoping it'll have, building on those 110 communications saying stop what you're doing? So what are you actually asking them to do, elephant wise?
We're asking them to let an independent vet go in and examine the elephants, which they'll never permit because that would not end well for them. They do fireworks during the summer, 3 nights a week, and it terrifies the elephants and. It terrifies all the animals, but it terrifies the elephants. They're sensitive to sound, and they don't know what's happening. And they may have started life hearing a gunshot kill their mother, and that's what this sounds like. Is lots of gunshots, and it's overwhelming. And people who live in the area, miles away, hear this the fireworks. And we're trying to get them to stop it, and that would be a very easy thing to do. And we found out, we know people who work there, and we had sources who would tell us that they sit and talk about this campaign every day, or they were talking about it every day. They directed their PR people to, as a first priority, to delete all the comments that people were making on their social media. And it affected them. I don't know what the result is going to be, and they stopped those fireworks shows stop at the end of the summer. They've stopped as of now, but they'll start again. But I don't know if they're going to agree to do anything or if they will do anything. But we know that we got their attention, and at least it shows you the power of people, you know, standing up and saying.
Yeah, especially those kind of numbers. It's not like 12 people wrote in and said, hey, we don't like what you're doing.
Right. Yeah. It's can you imagine, you know, every day having 10,000 emails in your inbox or 5,000 in your inbox, and you can't block them because we made it so that they all come from the person's email address. Mm. They don't come from one email address.
Sure.
So they can't be blocked, and they're still coming in. And the hope is, we have people who have contacted us about doing news stories about it, and that could be tremendous to a paper, what's the main paper in Tampa? The
Tampa Bay Times.
Tampa Bay Times is doing an article and has done all kinds of interviews. And that's when you would hope that people gets to the point that not just elephant people, but all kinds of people look at this and say, this, you know, we can't support this. This can't go on. And that would be a tremendous win as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
and that people are interested enough to write articles about it is encouraging to me.
So do you think the upshot, once some media coverage kicks in and this goes a little bit further, that the upshot will be trying to actually see about getting the elephants to move to the sanctuary when there's such limited space, or just to curtail activities that are driving the elephants nuts, like fireworks? And of course, I think they're near roller coasters and there's construction there. Yes. I mean, you've already pointed out how sensitive they are communicating from one to another. And have that kind of noise going, it must drive them insane.
Yeah, I mean, we're resigned to, we're not going to get them to a sanctuary.
Yeah.
And again, where would you put them? But getting them to stop the fireworks,
that's a victory of some kind for sure.
Right. There's a lot more horrific stuff going on. But if we could just get that done, that's an easy thing that would cost them nothing. And I don't think would change. I don't think anybody goes to Busch Gardens because there are fireworks, or don't go if there are not fireworks. I just don't. It's based on nothing, but I don't think that's the case. They could stop it. And they have a drone light show that they also use, which is supposedly quite impressive. And I'm still hopeful and optimistic that eventually they're going to have to stop doing these fireworks.
Yeah, that would be a significant victory. And like you say, they aren't going to move them, and I'm not sure there's good space. And someone that I think is in the know that's actually texting to my phone, so they're definitely some kind of insider, saying that, as an aside from what you said about, say, the elephant sanctuary in Tennessee has an F rating on Charity Navigator, which, you know, makes me nervous, too. I didn't realize they were that far off the mark, but that's one of the key sanctuaries. So either way, space is limited for elephants to go, so I guess the thing is let's improve their conditions where they are for now.
And That's right. I mean, our view is we're not doing this for this generation of elephants as much as future generations of elephants and future generations of people. This is not going to change in my lifetime, but you're doing this in the hope that at some point they're going to, this is not going to be something that we do. And we're going to look back and say, how did we ever do this? I can't believe you guys did this.
Right.
But that's going to take, you know, that could be 50, 100, it could take a lot of years, but...
Yeah, it'll be on a continuum. I think you're exactly right.
Exactly.
Any progress we can make. I mean, years ago, people would have said Ringling will never stop having elephants, and they did, so...
That was really quite a shocking event.
Yeah, but a lot of people worked long and hard for it, and it finally clicked, so I totally agree with your view of this. So we're in the final moment or so, sadly, of our time, David. So any final thing you want to say about either Busch Gardens or elephants or the weeping elephant that we didn't get a chance to address?
I would love people to join in on the campaign. If you go to the website, we have information that people may not know about elephants, and particularly what is done to elephants to make them, there are so many fake sanctuaries around the country and the world. They're not sanctuaries. They're petting zoos for elephants who have been beaten into submission. And you hope people learn about this and don't go to those sanctuaries, so-called sanctuaries, and keep an eye out. And if they can join the campaign, great. Like every nonprofit in the universe, we're always looking for donors, and people become aware of it and they take it in. I would be really thrilled about that, actually.
Okay, so we'll note to people that the website is weepingelephant.org, and that's where you can find out how to get involved with the campaign. That's where you can obviously make donations and learn more from some of the stuff we talked about and some of the stuff we didn't get a chance to talk about. But I will circle back with you, David, because as this campaign unfolds and some of the media coverage and et cetera unfolds, I think it'll be ripe for an update, because I like to think some serious progress will be made, and you're already making some progress.
Terrific. I'd love to do it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals. This is David Ebert from the Weeping Elephant Project, and again, the website is weepingelephant.org. Go check it out. Info, find out more. If you have a couple bucks, you can send their way. So much the better. So thank you very much, David.
Thank you very much, Duncan. Appreciate it.
In a moment, I'll speak with Noah Greenwald of the Center for Biological Diversity, who will discuss newly available info indicating the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has lost more than 35% of its staff under the Trump administration. Of course, this has tremendous implications for endangered species and others. We'll address this when Noah joins us in just a moment here on Talking Animals. Right now, though, let's jump into the Comedy Corner with Zoltan Kazaz with a piece called Overnight Pet. Today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
My wife, she has a new hobby. She's really into special needs animals. I don't know if that's made its way out here, Provo. If you don't know what special needs animals are, they're animals. They have special needs. That is all. There's this one, Oscar the Blind Cat. It was a cat that was born without any eyes, and they have a like page on Facebook, and my wife goes on there every day and cries. And that's what she does for fun. That's what she does for a good time. And it's weird, because I come home, and she's just on the computer. And, you know, me being a guy, I always think it's something I did. And then she goes, no. And then she turns the computer, and it's Oscar the Blind Cat. And he's like, look at Oscar. And he's adorable. He has no eyes. Just, and I'm like, oh. And then she goes, I want a special needs animal. I want one. I'm like, you don't ask for one. You get bestowed one. Because I don't know, you can't just go to the pound and be like, hey, what do you have in the back? Like, that's not how that works. I need, like, a three-legged dog or a cat with something. What do you have? You can't do that. That's why, you know, we got Jessica at the pound. That's where we got Jessica. And we didn't name her Jessica. They named her at the pound. And people always ask, like, why don't you change your name? Because that's wrong. You don't change someone's name. That's rude. Like, if you adopt a kid from another country, you can't just be like, yep, can't pronounce that. Your name's Jeff now. That's rude. You learn that person's name. So I got a cat named Jessica. Very much a fan. Jessica's overweight. She weighs more than she should for a cat, which sucks, because when people come over, no one blames the cat in that scenario. You know what I mean? No one comes over and goes, what happened here, sweetheart? A little heavy on the carbs? No, they look at you and they go, what'd you do to her? And that's not fair, because I try. We have the laser pointer. I got the stick with the feather. I'm always running around my house. Come on, sweetheart, let's get the cardio going. But she's not that into it. My wife and I, we bought diet formula kibble. They make diet formula kibble, and they have rules, just one cup per day, because you're on a diet, Jessica. We tried, but then at 2 in the morning, Jessica would come into our bedroom at night, climb onto our bed, and then stand on my head. 22 and a half pounds of her, you guys, on my skull. And she would come down into my ear and just go,
that's Zoltan Kazaz here on Talking Animals with Overweight Pet from his album Cat Jokes on Talking Animals. Now it's time to talk with Noah Greenwald of the Center for Biological Diversity about this newly available info indicating the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has lost more than 35% of its staff under the Trump administration. Here's Noah Greenwald on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Noah.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Oh, sure.
So let's start, if we could, by asking you to provide just a kind of a basic, I guess, overview of the Center for Biological Diversity.
Sure. The Center for Biological Diversity is a national organization that seeks to protect endangered species and their habitats, as well as wild places, and to secure a future for the natural world and all of us that depend upon it.
Okay, cool. And your role there is Endangered Species Co-Director. So what does that involve? What are some of the responsibilities you carry?
Sure. So I supervise an excellent team of lawyers and biologists seeking to protect wildlife across America from extinction. And some of the things we do is petition to have species listed as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act, sue to ensure that those species get that consideration, sue to obtain critical habitat for species, fight projects that harm wildlife, et cetera. All things centered around implementing the Endangered Species Act. One of the
one of the strongest laws for protecting biodiversity in the world.
For sure. Okay, so I think this connects directly now to the main thing we're here to talk about today. This information about the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service staffing, the levels obviously are worrying. Tell us about how those findings came about and what your reaction to them is.
Yeah, so I mean, I think as most people are aware, the Trump administration, upon entering office, created DOGE, headed by Elon Musk, and, you know, sought to fire and pressure out staff across government, and Fish and Wildlife Service was no exception. They, you know, we obtained rosters of all staff at Fish and Wildlife Service through the Freedom of Information Act, and we obtained those for 24, 25, 26, and what we found is that between 2024 and 2026, the Fish and Wildlife Service lost 36% of its staff, over 4,000 staff, including roughly 1,900 scientists. You know, so these are people who have been working to protect particular wildlife species for decades and have a lot of knowledge about what those species need. And to lose that knowledge and to lose the staff is just a tragedy that won't be easy to backfill.
Yeah, so I guess the implications are significant, and within your purview there, the endangered species, I guess, in particular, are affected by that huge drop in the scientists and other specialists that have been working in that area for years and years. What can be done, if anything, to help mitigate this this drastic drop and the implications of it, therefore?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, some of the things people can do are to, you know, reach out to their congressional delegation and let them know that, you know, they support protections for endangered species, that they want the Fish and Wildlife Service to be fully staffed and funded. And so, you know, after the midterms, perhaps we have a different Congress that's more interested in providing funding and resources to Fish and Wildlife Service to ensure that we don't allow species to go extinct. It's certainly something that we're working on. We're also, you know, continuing to pressure Fish and Wildlife Service to do more. You know, even before these staff cuts, Fish and Wildlife Service really struggled to meet its duties to protect endangered species and to manage national wildlife refuges across the country. You know, for example, just listing species, they've had a backlog of more than 400 species waiting for protection decisions for years.
We're just about out of time, Johan. Sorry.
Oh, no, I just was going to say the Trump administration, you know, cut funding for listing new species, so species like the monarch butterfly and the eastern hellbender salamander are stuck in purgatory waiting for protection, even though they've been found to warrant that protection.
Oh, well, it sounds sounds discouraging, but it sounds like we have hopes for the midterms and maybe when there's a new president in office as well.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Noah, for joining us. This is Noah Greenwald of the Center for Biological Diversity, and thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thanks, Duncan.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Talking Animals on WNF Tampa.